All right. I'm going to start with a question to the audience or to our guests. So you're going to have a choice here. Do you want the depressing question or the less depressing question?
You need depressing it is. Depressing.
Yeah. Okay. So what is the percentage of economics grad students that are experiencing moderate to severe symptoms of depression or anxiety?
Oh, because they're economics grad students. That's the dismal science. This is guaranteed to be a very high percentage, right?
I'm going to give you 68.
Okay. I don't know. But 2 out of 3 economics students are depressed. Yeah. Should be laughing about this.
I don't think. Yeah. So is this, wait. Is this clinical depression, like clinically diagnosed depression? Or is this, they just report being a little bit unhappy occasionally?
So this is based on, according to the paper, a clinically approved survey of top 8 economics grad student programs in the U.S.
All right. I'm going to say 40%. 40.
It's self-reported. What was it, large and minor? Or minor and large? Or what it was?
Moderate to severe, whatever that means.
Moderate to severe. So they used some sort of instrument asking about everything except, are you depressed, right? They just said, do you do this during the day? And then it's moderate to severe. So anything, I would give it over 50%. So
52. I say 40.
I go down to 35 because we need some space for the minor ones.
The good old anchoring effect. Okay, you've got a very, very pessimistic idea of econ students, but the answers are logged. And so, hello and welcome to a very special crossover episode of Desk Reject, the PhD cast this time around. The podcast where usually 4 PhD students discuss or / moan about being grad students at the WU Vienna University of Economics and Business in German. Today, we're doing something a bit different. We're very happy to announce that for today's episode, 2 members of the Desk Reject hosting team, Philip and myself, are joined by 2 hosts of the This Is Research podcast, Nick Berente, Associate Professor of IT at the Mendoza College of Business, and Jan Recker, Nucleus Professor for Information Systems and Digital Innovation at the University of Hamburg. We've been fans of the This Is Research podcast ever since its inception, so we are very excited to bring you this crossover episode. And right off the bat, I'd like to ask Jan, what is a Nucleus Professor, and is it still possible to be a professor of analog innovation?
That's a nice question. So first of all, thanks for having us. I mean, we're big fans too. I mean, I am. Yeah? Nick is not, because he can't speak German. I know if you're...
Express
your
ein bisschen Deutsch.
Ein bisschen Deutsch.
Das ist
Sprache.
Yeah. So, good on you. I think it's a really, really cool thing that you guys are doing. And it's great that we have this crossover episode. Second, Nick is a full professor now, right? Whoop, whoop, Nick.
That's true. I'm promoted.
Congratulations.
Yep. I've arrived. Yeah.
The website still says associate professor.
It'll catch up, I suppose.
Yeah. And thirdly, a Nucleus professor, it's a name, a title given by the university for that chair, because it comes out of a particular funding pot out of the excellence strategy. They became excellence university and they can hire certain professors from that. And these professors are called Nucleus professors. So I'm coerced. I'm enabled to use that title, but that's all it means. And yes, of course, there's still analog innovation. There you go. These are my answers.
All it means, all Nucleus means is you've arrived, right? It doesn't matter what you say before that, as long as you have some language before the word professor, that means you have a chaired professorship. That means you've reached the highest, right? And that's the beauty of academia. It keeps hanging a carrot out in front of you for the next step, right? So it's like, you get the tenure track job. Then you get tenure, an associate professor somewhere, or different countries have a different like next step. And then you get full professor. So I'm there, but then I'm looking at Recker. Hey, now I need a Nucleus professor.
I need a chair.
So there's always something keeping you motivated, right?
Just like collecting Pokemon.
And even if you get there, I mean, and then there's, of course, different names. I mean, nucleus is fine, I guess. No one knows what that means. But there's an Einstein professor, Jan Mentling, who used to be at J-Bird, who used to be at VU Vienna, and he's the Einstein professor. It doesn't get much better than that. Although, of course, if you're the Einstein professor, maybe then there's the, you know, some other title that's even better than that. I don't know. It's a little bit like the pyramid schemes that you have in the consultancy companies. You think you're a partner, but there's another level of partnership that you can get to.
I think this nicely ties to the first topic that we wanted to address, right, Alex?
Exactly, because we'll start right at the bottom of the pyramid and ask you guys. So there's a quote that Philip gave me that we're both not sure where it's from, but it goes, the best way to get a good PhD student is to start with a great one. So we were wondering, from your perspective, what actually defines a good PhD student?
That quote is awful.
Off to a great start.
You get a great now PhD student, destroy him or her.
I can tell you the things that don't work. And then Nick and I touched upon this a little bit in one of our episodes. But I tell you, one of the realizations that I made over the, you know, the years that I'd worked with PhD students, never go by GPA, grade point average. Mm. It's a horrible predictor of them becoming a good, whatever that's supposed to mean, a good PhD student. Like the ones that come in with straight A's, they're usually really bad in their PhD. So I try not to even look at that, right? So there's a minimum threshold or something. You have to have a certain GPA, otherwise you're not being admitted to the doctoral program. Okay. But that's the only way that I look at it. It's just a hygiene factor. And above that, I really don't look at your GPA. Like, because I find it to be a really bad predictor.
Okay. All right. So this is what we have. We have test scores. So in the US, right? It's like GRE or GMAT or something mm-hmm. like that. And then there's GPA, which is how you've done. And then there's, so these are signals that we use to at least admit our PhD students. Then another one is, which schools did they go to, right? So then that's mm-hmm. that's giving you something and then we have a number of these, and they're all academic signals. And what's really funny is that they don't really mean much, other than a really low one is kind of a bad signal. So although a 4-point GPA to a 4.2 or a 3.8, there's probably no difference between them. But if someone has a very low GPA, well, maybe they don't belong in a PhD program. Similarly with test scores, right? If someone's in the top 25%, top 15%, top 10%, that probably says something about intellectual ability, but there are a lot of people that aren't, you know, top 1% intellects doing just fine in academia, right? They understand their specialty and they do well. So I think like Recker said, a lot of these things are hygiene factors, but so you can't have real negative. So I think Recker is not looking at GPAs, but you're not going to accept anybody who flunks or gets C's or you know, does really badly.
No, but the system, but the system doesn't take care of that for me. You're not admissible to the program. That's it, right? So, and therefore, I don't really worry about it. Tell you what I do, though. Like when someone applies to be a PhD student, whether it's funded or not, with a stipend or not, I give them a little task where I want them to write 2 pages or, you know, 2 times 1 page by Friday. You know, in like 4 days, by definition. I don't want to see something in writing. I want to see how they argue. I find you can read a lot from that just half a page, 1 page, where you give them a task. It's a simple task, such as find a nice paper on innovation and tell me why it's a nice paper. Something like this. Yeah, just make an argument. I do that with all of them, and I use that as a measure. I sometimes feel I can read a lot into how people write or argue in writing. That's what I do, and I find that to be a nice predictor. Next to, of course, an interview, but I don't really count much on interviews either, because it's an artificial situation of a 20-minute talk with a structured questionnaire. I don't really, you know, you're taking a gamble, I guess, I suppose, with your PhD student, and they take a gamble too. That's how I look at it.
Your writing is smart, right? Because so much of what we do, it depends on your ability to write and crank out paragraphs. I disagree with you on the interview, because I think with the interview, you get to kind of meet the person a little bit. And in the end, where it's a social interaction with the PhD student, you want someone who, you know, you feel you can talk to and interact with in a comfortable or professional manner, right? So, but here's the deal, right? Is that, you know, we can talk about all these things we use to filter out and to maybe admit PhD students. But here's the funny little thing about academia is that there are so many brilliant people who made it through their PhD and are way smarter than I am, and for whatever reason did not succeed in publishing. They did not, and some of that, and there are two reasons they do it. One is they never quite got the knack. They didn't figure out the game. There was something, and I have explanations for this. The one explanation I have for this is that, as Brecker said, they're A students, right? They were perfect students and they're used to getting things perfect. So, you know, we're dealing with judgment calls and flaws, and you can never reach perfection in getting out a little paper. All you can do is good enough, right? So that's the one group that just never figures out the game. The other ones that don't succeed are the ones who hate it, who just look at this. They're like, what are we doing? Why are we writing papers? No one reads these papers. You know, this sucks. Everybody's just talking to each other. I'm going to industry, right? And what I found is that every time it's someone who hates academia like that, where they're just like, oh, this is awful. Those people have never had experience in the real world. Because almost without exception, people who have had some work experience come to academia and they're like, this is great. I love this, right? And it's those who, like, you know, grass is greener, and then they get demoralized from this and they think it's all nonsense and then they leave, right?
Those, yeah, the truth they is tend grass to not is have pretty a brown everywhere.
Yeah. The grass is brown everywhere. So what do you guys think? I mean, like, you're PhD student, you've been around the block for a couple of years. I mean, what is the most critical skill that you think is important?
I'd like to challenge, or I'd let Philip challenge you, because you mentioned something about signals. And I think both Philip and I have heard this line of argument, also from our supervisors, or from not just from our supervisors, but from a lot of professors around. And it's not about the school or the grades, right, Philip?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking that, I mean, this is where's the cutoff, right? You said that. Yeah, I'm not looking for the GPA, but and it doesn't really matter, but it matters. Maybe it doesn't matter whether you're in the top 1% or the top 8%. I think there you might be right. But as you said, only the ones really at the top get admitted and be part of this game. But I try to reflect on what you said, what makes a good PhD student. Of course, thought about myself
as a great PhD student.
Talking about great PhD students. But as I perceive it, it's something that's so intangible and so hard to assess prior to starting a PhD. And this is constant curiosity for something that is quite focused, right? I'm really interested in a lot of things, and I like to shift around a lot, but this is really not demanded in academia to a certain degree, right? I need to really dig deep into one certain element, become an expert on that, and try to look at it from different angles. But I have this internal drive to switch around, right? How I perceive people who are the most successful are the ones who can do that really, really well, right? To develop somewhat of a blindsided focus on this one thing. How do you see that? Do you look for that? Do you want someone who's really focused on one topic or?
I think focus is important, because this curiosity and sort of like, oh, here's a new shiny object, and then the next one, the next shiny object comes, and then you're always chasing the dog's tail. Yeah. That can't be helpful, because, you know, the part of that PhD is that you actually get into one topic and, you know, spend the next 3 years on that one. And I think it's more a question of motivation and being really interested in this thing for the next 3 years. Not right now. A lot of things are interesting right now. It doesn't mean that 3 years down the track, you still be interested in that. And then it becomes really, really hard to persist with something that you don't give a damn about anymore. What I find, like, challenge me on this one. I think a wonderful skill to have is reading. But it's not what most people think reading means, I think, right? So number one, I think a lot of people just don't know how to read, and they don't read a lot. And I think it does help if you've always read a lot. A lot of academic knowledge is in the form of books and articles. Whether you like it or not, you'll have to read. Yeah, but it's not that you're reading a John Grisham novel from start to finish. You know, reading a paper or reading a book is to me a different thing. It's this ability to pick up the idea and pick up the main things from 350 pages of text in a relatively quickly manner. So I think the students do great that sort of have a knack for that. maybe because they've always read a lot, or maybe they just pick that up really, really quickly. The ones that struggle are the ones that take 3 weeks to read this one article that I gave them to read, right? That can't work either.
Let me jump in on this with the strategy for reading, right? And this is the difference between scholarly reading and, like you said, a John Grisham novel. You want to almost think of it as, you know, any particular article or particular book by itself probably is not going to be that useful. If you're going to understand, you need to understand a trajectory of thought. You need to understand what that book is responding to, or what that article is responding, where it fits in the kind of continuity of scholarship, right? And that's what marks the difference between someone who knows their stuff and someone who's read a little bit, is that you need to understand, okay, where did this conversation start and why did it start? Where's it going? Where does this particular thing fit in? And then you create this kind of edifice. You create this understanding of the field or of the trajectory and where it is and where it was. And I think that's the difference between, so it's more like, instead of reading a book, it's being, you know, it's studying literature. You know, yeah. I think there's a big difference.
I love that. And I think it's a critical skill to develop a mental model of a conversation that goes on over a longer period of time. But then the second element, or the third element in a way, comes in that I find crucial. And this is stepping over a few borders, right? To be creative and try to find an angle in the conversation where something new arises. And what I see a lot is that, those students that you just described, they read a lot, they really know their stuff, and then they go a tiny step, right? They do something that has been done before, and they don't want to let's say contradict established opinions or ideas. But I think what really makes a great paper is stepping over a few borders and kicking over a few gravestones, if you know what I mean. How do you think about that?
I also wanted to add, it's the challenge also generally about reading is, at least for me, it just doesn't feel like work. So every time there is so many things to do, not just as a grad student, but in general in academia, it feels like writing or working with your data is work, and reading just feels like indulgence. So that's it's a challenge to sit down with a book or with a stack of papers and then read and just see the time go by and feel like you've done absolutely nothing.
And then you've got people like Wrecker bugging you and saying, come on, why don't you write with our collaborations? That's what he does with me. He bothers me and says, why don't you write? I'm like,
You write? You should be writing, not reading. So I like this conversation, but I also think it's completely far, far away from the reality that I know. So I don't know about you, you guys in the US, Nick, you got to tell us. But I think what I see in Europe, and also when I was in Australia, which is similar. So first of all, the students that want to come in and do a PhD, they have no idea. They have no idea what they're meant to be doing. They have no idea what it means. They also have no idea of who they're actually asking to become the supervisor of the program. Sometimes, or now, they have a sense of the different universities and maybe the different departments where they apply, that there's a difference between, I don't know, the University of Stuttgart and the University of Klagenfurt or something. I don't know. Back in the day, I certainly had no idea. Yeah, but I don't think they know exactly what they're getting into in this 4-year program, a one-on-one with a supervisor. They usually don't know their supervisors, absolutely no idea. They have just a few signals. They have some hearsay. Maybe they see the CV and they think there's a good person or something. But by and large, I think they have no idea what they're getting into. Secondly, also, it's not that they look back and reflect and think like, I'm good at reading, I'm curious mind, and I do have a knack for finding nice new angles on topics like this. No, most students that I know, they say, I want to do a PhD. Don't know, maybe they want to have that title, maybe not. Maybe someone told them that they're a good grad students, maybe they had a really high GPA. That's usually why they think they want to do a PhD. Then they come in and say like, can I do a PhD with you, and what can I do? Like, that's the reality that I know, where they don't come in with a fully fledged idea. Maybe they do in the US, where it's like, I have this idea, I want to write a dissertation on this topic. Most students that I've seen are like, I want to do a PhD, you got anything? Tell me what I should be doing the next 4 years, and I'll do that, and then I'll get my PhD for that. That is more the reality that I know.
So let's get concrete then. What would you wish that people do?
I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying this is what it is. I'm not even labeling it a bad thing, right?
There's nothing wrong with it.
I think it would be interesting. Right? I think because I'm not sure, but I think at least from our side, some of our listeners aren't even in a PhD yet. They're in a master. So I think it'd be really interesting to hear from your experience. What is the thing you wish that candidates did before they even applied or when they're considering to apply?
I look at it differently, right? So I used to run the PhD programs at most of my universities I work for, right? PhD program director. 95% of the problem, you only see the problems then. You never see the good students, right? You only see the problems. And 95% of these problems are student-supervisor relationship problems. Mm-hmm. Like that connection doesn't work. Yeah, and they, you know, it doesn't even matter whether the student is to blame or the supervisor is to blame. With all relationship, there's usually something on both sides. But that relationship doesn't work. And a lot of harm and, you know, problems and tears and all that sort of stuff and a lot of time you could really quickly solve by making sure that when this relationship forms, that you have a better sense of whether that's going to work or not. And we're watching for early signals. Very often we don't have early signals and we find out 4 years into the program that this doesn't work and it couldn't have worked and it shouldn't have worked and it should have been stopped a long time ago, right? So usually that's one of the problems that I see quite a lot.
I would totally agree with you, but the problem that I see is that it is impossible to assess how it will feel for you personally to do a PhD because it's such a specific situation to be in, 3 years with one topic, 5 years with one topic, being dependent on someone who you also work for over 5 years and who you might like or might not like. And this is a relationship that develops and it is not predetermined whether you and your supervisor have a great fit or not. So I think we can't circumvent that. I think it is more important to communicate more clearly what a PhD actually is. I just to tie it back to my experience, I loved to be with people and I love to work in teams and so on and so forth. I couldn't program, I couldn't code. And what I now do is sit in a room and code, or what I would love to do is just sit in a room and code all day and work with data. And this is something that arose from doing the PhD. And I would have never said that before. And I was 24 or 25 when I joined the PhD program. So I think you're totally right, but I think it is inaccessible, this information, how it will develop. We just have to do it.
Yeah, and there's not one path, right?
Yeah.
Different PhDs look different. And I guess this is what I would do. If I were going into a PhD program and I were a new student, I would look around at it and I would think, okay, first off, whatever I want to study is less relevant than having a realistic view of what the academic job market looks like, right? And like, so for example, here in the US for the last few years, if you were an analytics person and you know you came from a pretty good school, did some good research, there are tons of jobs, right? We are hiring as many of those analytics people as we can. Half of them are doing, say, econometrics or things that they're doing in other fields like economics. And say that you mentioned economics PhDs, right? They haven't been hiring quite as much, right? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes economics here in the US is not even in the business school. So even those that do hire get paid a lot less. And then what are they doing? They're essentially studying the same topic using econometric techniques, right? And it's like, wait, I went to my PhD in economics because I knew it and then I'm not getting a job. Meanwhile, if I would have gone to like a business school, and I think, you know, students need to think about that. And at least in the US, the number one paid faculty is finance, right? In business schools all across the US. So if I were, say, interested in finance stuff and economic stuff, I might go get a PhD in finance at a good business school in the US because not only am I in demand in business schools and get paid the most, I could also get a job in Wall Street and everything. The problem with finance is it's a really lame thing to study. It's so boring. All you're studying is stocks and all of that. So number two, well, really, I mean, it's awful. If you're really into stocks and that's really what you're excited about, you want to like do an incremental thing over the last person in stocks, then yeah. But to me, that's just totally uninspiring. So number two pay in the US anyway is right now analytics, right? So if you're, and you can come to that from stats, you know, you can come to it from a number of different places. And these are the folks who are doing machine learning. They have to know some econometrics, they have to know stats, but this is big. And there are PhD, we have one, there are a number of others that that are popping up all over. A lot of operations programs, a lot of information systems programs are essentially creating these analytics people. And right now, business schools in the US are beating so that's what I would do. I would be strategic a bit at the programs I would go into if I wanted an academic career and see where there are jobs, you know?
Mm-hmm. Definitely true. No.
I'd then move a little bit forward now. We've talked about what we should be doing before we start a PhD, and a topic I think that is very near and dear to my heart and everybody Phillips as well is this idea around, or that is often beaten into us, is we need a researcher identity. So this is something, once you start your PhD, once you start getting into it, you figure it out, you need to read, you need to write. The next thing you get confronted with is, okay, what's your identity?
In your PhD program?
During your PhD program, yeah.
Well, that's early.
At least it was for me. Emerge. I think it was for Philip as well. Once you start going to talk to other researchers or to think about, you know, moving, you're pretty sure you want to, you're in your PhD for the academic career path rather than the, I just want to get a title career path. At least in my experience, that's something that a lot of mentors or senior researchers can agree upon, is you need, it seemed to need a research identity. Now, what we were wondering is
it might this, form over a couple of years or something, right? So
yeah, so I was wondering if this is just a tip given by a lot of researchers because it just developed over time. It's some kind of survivor bias, and so they see what helped them out and it developed over time, so they're kind of imploring this, oh, you need to do this as early as possible because this is so important. So I would have loved to hear what you guys think about this kind of urgency of developing a researcher identity, and then also what does that even mean?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts here. I mean, I don't think you can create an identity. An identity emerges. You know, people will put you in a box, or they will try to put you in a box. I don't think you necessarily create that box. I don't know how you would actually do that in a PhD, right? So I think one takeaway is, right, make sure you can be fit in a box somewhere. I think one dangerous thing is if you, in your quest to, you know, do research and publish a lot, that you do everything and anything. That's very difficult, right? So because then you're not known for anything. You're just the guy that has 7 papers to their name, right? And that's really difficult because then people don't know where to put you in the box other than the box this guy publishes anything he can get his hands on. And that's not an identity you want to have. Now, you know, I'm not saying you created this, but this is probably an identity that you will assume, but because the identity is an emergent property, right? So you don't create it, but it emerges from you and how other people look at you. So what can you do? You can try to see, okay, what will I become known for? What is my thing? And you better own that thing, and you also better like it. Yeah. So I think, you know, for example, for me, all the US people think Jan does design signs or something. And I'm like, I hate that stuff. Like, I've never, you know, I do very little of this. And like, why do you put this in this box? And for years, I resisted this box and said, like, no, don't put me in that box. Until at some stage, I realized, well, it's actually quite helpful if you put that, if people put you in that box, let's try to own that box. So I'm using words like design when I talk about my work. Yeah. Why? Because I didn't create the box, but others have created it for me. And it's quite helpful for them to figure out what type of guy I am. So, you know, I don't think you can create this. I also don't think there's a lot of urgent thing. It'll happen anyway, but you want to stay a little bit in control over that identity, I suppose.
I heard that it's very important for the job talks after the PhD, either for a tenure track position or for an interesting postdoc, to have this clear focus and this clear identity, because it projects in the future and gives an outlook on what you will do. You reacted a little bit more careful. Would you say that on the PhD level, this might be too early and it is hindsight bias either way?
I mean, I think I agree with Wrecker. It emerges. And anybody who's trying to force fit it ahead of time, if you like something and that's what you want your identity to be, then go for it, right? The earlier you converge, that's nice. And then you get a specialty and it's all good. I think force fitting yourself into something like that prematurely is not doing anybody any good. Usually what I would say is you do two things, right? One is your main research, and then you dip your toe into something else. So you have your main research stream, whatever that is. And I would generally recommend for PhD students that be some sort of theory. Because I actually think theory sells, theory gets cited, and theory is easy to label yourself with. And then your second stream could either be another theory or maybe a method or maybe something else where you're actually looking to contribute in that other thing. There are certain methods like econometrics, right? You don't want to be an econometric specialist, right? You throw a rock, you can hit someone who's an econometric specialist, right? So you can use that tool, but if that's all you got, it's going to be really hard to get a unique research identity. That's just another econometrician looking for data, trying to establish unidirectional causation somewhere, right? So ideally you have a domain, a phenomenon, and I think a theory that you would come from. And then that's how you label yourself. Mm-hmm. If you're kind of atheoretic, then yeah, phenomenon. I study, you know, fill in the blank, peer-to-peer organizing or whatever, right? And then you'll just use kind of default economic theory. But there again, I agree with Recker. It emerges, right? You do things, you read things, and then something you like, and then maybe the first study that went well, right? Then just keep going with it, and that emerges. You know, early in my career, I think most of my stuff and most people thought of me as institutional theory, right? That's what I did. Mm-hmm. I continue to, and I'm a specialist in my field. And its application of institutional theory, right? Is that all I've done? No way. And the older I get, the more I'm doing a variety of things. And now I'm really excited about AI and I continue to have, I've always thought of myself as an innovation person, and institutional theory was one of the things I was getting at with innovation, but outside people just label me, whatever, institutional. So I'll go with it, right? That's where I made an impact in my field. But yeah, I think it evolves afterwards. It's not something you realize it after doing it. You do something mm-hmm. hard and then you realize it, right?
How do you deal with what I touched upon earlier a little bit is that I have this jumping around curiosity and then something else emerges. And if I have this strong focus, I don't know, managerial cognition, whatever, and then something other comes up and I would love to jump on it. I assume you have it too. If you do, how do you deal with that? If you don't, why not?
Well, this goes back to, you know, Nick puts that theory up there. I wouldn't necessarily. So, you know, in my take, then maybe your identity is not coined by a particular theory, managerial cognition, which means you can vary it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I tend to give that advice to saying, like, look, you can build it's really important to build a portfolio. I think Nick is absolutely spot on. He said, like, he has his main focus, but also do other things. The students that I've seen struggle a lot are the ones that only do that one dissertation project. Yeah, I think it gives them this little, like, too narrow a view. And that if they get stuck, they got nothing else to fall back on. I think the students that do better, they have a bunch of little things on the side.
It's both. Yeah. Well, it's both. Yeah. You need to establish the repertoire for perspective, but you need a focus, right? Yeah. And really, they say, you know, there's the foxes and the hedgehogs. This is the Isaiah Berlin's idea. And, you know, everyone says the hedgehogs are the ones that achieve in academia, right? They pick something and they just go deep, deep, deep. They understand the discourse. They know what's next and they specialize in that very narrow thing. So I think there's pretty much universal agreement, especially early in your field. The more of a hedgehog you can be, the better. That doesn't mean that's all you do, but that's primarily what you do. Now, with that said, there are a lot of foxes that do quite well. Now, chances are these foxes started off as hedgehogs. So my advisor, his name's Kali Luthanen. He started in a very specific area using speech act theory in information systems development. And he did that for a decade. Now he literally does everything, right? So he kind of emerged to a fox from an early hedgehog. And I would say, you know, that's what you want to be. Or that's what I guess I've gone, the direction I've gone. Everyone doesn't have to go that way. But, you know, you want to try and start as much of a hedgehog. Don't prematurely be a hedgehog. But once you've found your game, dig into it and then be open to expanding as you mature in your field, right?
Mentioned to me, I don't know who it was. I think it might have been Isaac Benbazat. I can't remember. Anyway, but he said, it takes 10 years to become an expert in something. And then he can do something else. And that sounds like a long time, but it's not, because, you know, 5 years of that is already your PhD, which means when you do become a hedgehog in one area for 5 years, all we're asking is for your postdoc years and your early and assistant prof, whatever the next stage is, just keep doing that because you're already pretty good at this. And then you've spent 10 years on something. And that is a little bit like the hedgehog mentality. And it is a good idea because that allows you to be productive. Mm. I've changed everything, method, theory, and domain at some stage in my career, granted after I had tenure, but that takes years. Yeah. And I thought, oh, no problem. I read really quickly. I'm really, really awesome. I'll do that pivot really, really quickly. No, you don't. Yeah, absolutely not. So it's really difficult to jump a little bit too much, too quickly, too early. So, and you are building an identity by keep on working on the same topic. And also you will be able to publish much better because you know the area, you know the conversions, you know the literature, you know the methods, you know the standards of rigor, you know what people expect in that one area. When I moved from process management and modeling to innovation and blah, boy, you know, it takes a long time. Mm-hmm. You're better trained at that stage, yeah. But you still, like, you have to do so much reading. You have no idea who the people are, what they favor, what the standards are. You literally is the first couple of papers then in that new area, they're going to be shit. They're going to be stupid little papers saying things that other people have said much better, much earlier, but you didn't know at that point. Mm-hmm. So I think there is something to it. Yeah.
What about the challenge of chasing a curiosity? What about this idea of, because from your last podcasts, I feel like what you agreed upon is that resilience, for example, and or maybe grit, call it as well, is really important. This kind of maybe hedgehog mentality of you need to find your lane and stick to it. Have you ever noticed a kind of a point of where the grittiness or the resilience is actually a barrier, where people are pursuing, or especially maybe PhDs are pursuing something that is turning into a kind of a sunk cost issue, where it's just...
So it sounds like you're mixing up the way at least I conceive of grit and resilience with persistence in a research direction. And I don't know about persistence in a research direction. You know, if it's a dumb direction, then persistence in a dumb direction is probably not a good thing, right?
But can it not feel like resilience from a subjective?
Well, this is what really... the way I use grit and resilience is this, just plain old toughness, right? It's, you have to get through the data one more time, right? Doing initial submissions is usually not the hard part. It's the third revision, fourth revision, where you're looking at the data again. You have to address that lame reviewer concern. You have to do it thoroughly. You're busy, right? And then you just force yourself to do it, do a good job, make sure it's when your co-authors send you that paper and then you're ready to just send it off because it's quick. But instead you go look at the data, look at the results, make sure you understand each result, and then contact your co-author and be like, why is this negative? And then dig into it, right? It requires a certain conscientiousness, a certain roll up your sleeves and get dirty again, and then do it again with the next revision, do it again with the next revision. It's grueling. It's painful. It sucks. And that's what I mean by grit and resilience, to pick yourself up, do it for the next one. That's how you get a top tier journal, right? An article published. And sometimes your junior people haven't learned that yet. Sometimes your co-authors are a little too senior and are expecting you to do it. So if no one takes responsibility for slogging through it, then, and ideally the best collaborations are when everyone takes responsibility for slogging through it, then people are happy and you do it, right? So I think that picking yourself up, forcing yourself to put words on the page, forcing yourself to again go through the data, forcing yourself to again, you know, that's what I mean by grit. That's what I mean by resilience. It's not the fun of creating the paper the first time. It's the entire process of seeing it through. And I think a lot of people don't have that, or they don't want it. They just don't have the priorities for it. Now, what you're talking about is persistence in a bad idea. And, you know, I don't know if persisting in the face of a lot of rejection is always a good, sometimes you're right. Other times, the rejection is telling you, even if you're right, who cares?
I think that especially students, they put too much value on what are sunk costs. It's just sunk costs. It doesn't matter. Like, you can, you know, leave it be. Like, the chances are you're probably wrong. Chances are whatever you're doing is not going to lead anywhere. Yeah. And after a while, you know, you don't put too much emphasis. Yeah. I just spent 2 years on this, but it didn't go anywhere. Well, you know, whatever. Let's do something else instead. I think in the beginning, it's really, really tough because you're very aware of the sunk cost and you don't know that, you know, chances are it's not going to go anywhere. So I think, you know, students tend to put that too much high, and then they run into the problem that they have done this work. So it's got to be published and it's got to be successful. No. You know, no, most probably not. Yeah. And that's difficult. That's a learning process. And I think over time, Nick, you probably have a lot of projects that at some stage you ended because it didn't go anywhere. And they used to bug me a lot, and they don't bug me as much anymore. It's just a normal process anymore. So if you free yourself a little bit from the idea that just because you've just done a lot of work on something, that it's got to be good, and it's got to be successful, because the reality is probably not. It's just normal. Otherwise, it wouldn't be research, right?
The time is moving so fast, and there's one topic that I want to address definitely. So I would just push it here. And that's the one that I wanted or hinted at the beginning. And this is envy, right? We talked about the different levels of professors, and we have the Einstein professors and the one with even higher accolades. And I think it's at that level, I can't really feel it, but on the level of the PhD, at least I feel a lot of envy. I just opened LinkedIn, I just opened Twitter, and this one guy who's in his second year just published an SMJ, or Alex is currently in Harvard and I'm still in Vienna. And so I think the salience of success is so high in academia that it can be overwhelming. And I can just open any device and just feel the envy flow through me.
Aww, you feel, that's no, horrible,
it's
Philip.
No, it's fine. I learned to live with that. I do lots of sports to manage, but how do you deal with that? Is it something that you felt in your career as well? Is it something that still drives or triggers you, or is it something that goes away after time?
No, I don't think it's like I don't know. I can only speak for myself. I don't think that I'm envious. Mm-hmm. I see it as I'm certainly competitive. And even with my friends, I'm sort of engaged in friendly competitiveness. But this is not a zero-sum.
Fuck you, Alex.
Alex, he's holding
up in a Harvard sweater.
Hey, Alex, can you? I want to have one as well. Just to pose. Just bring one for me. So it's not a zero-sum game. I mean, if Nick publishes a paper, it doesn't diminish my ability or chances of probabilities of publishing as well. It's just good for him, you know. Like it's like I don't lose anything. Mm-hmm. And if you're the other second year PhD student got this SMJ article, well, good for them. Like, you know, yeah, good on them. It doesn't diminish you at all, because it has absolutely no bearing on what you're doing. So in a competitive sense, it's like, nah, he's ahead of me or something, or she's ahead of me, maybe. But envy, I wouldn't look at it as envy.
Okay. Does it develop over time? Like is that muscle that you build, or do you notice that people just come in with a lack of envy, and that's just a character trait?
Well, all right. So I'm no specialist on envy, right? But I do know it's a decision, right? It's not something you have to feel. I think there are so many things in the world are decisions that we somehow chalk up to emotion, right? And I think something like envy, you could just tell yourself, I'm not envious, right? And I mean, I just heard a really cute quote the other day, something like, you know, compete with yourself and cheer for everyone else, right? And I think the number one cure to any kind of envy is to just be goal oriented, right? Is to, and sure, you can have friendly competitions, you can do stuff like that. Life is, you know, we've talked about this. It's a marathon. It's your career, your academic career is the next 20 years. You need a 20-year perspective on this, right? So it's particularly the first 10 years define what you're doing. 1 year almost doesn't matter. Right? 1 or 2 years here and there almost does not matter, right? It's a 10-year, you're thinking in decades. When you think in decades and you have goals, the trick is to be in alignment with your goals. And, you know, it's one of those things where my father-in-law used to be an accountant for very wealthy people. And this is what he said, is that sometimes people got wealthy young. You know, they sold a business at age 30 and made a big amount of money or something like that. But you can't count on that. Right. And it's kind of like your friend, Philip, where, sometimes people get an SMJ in their second year. I actually know people who have gotten very top tier publications during their PhDs that ended up not even getting tenure when they got out in the world. Right. So keep in mind, one publication here, there, great, whatever. So someone could get lucky early, but you can't plan on that luck. Right. And you shouldn't resent the 30-year-old who sold their business and made a bunch of money. And what he said is that what you can count on, however, is that everybody between the ages of 50 and 60, if they set themselves up right, can print money for that decade. And then they save a huge amount of money for their retirement. And then he's like, well, how do you do that? Well, you build. It's a 30-year plan. It's your 20s, your 30s, and your 40s. You build towards age 50 to then print money. I think it's the same with academia. You, in the end, it's a meritocracy. At any point, you know, your school gives you a leg up, your advisor gives you a leg up. There are all these ways that some people get have privilege that others don't, right? In the short term, absolutely. So if you don't have the privileges others have, you're not in your roost there at Harvard, and right, you're starting back a little bit. But remember, you've got 10 years, and there's so many angles to success. Figure out your angle, work your way through, and it's a 10-year plan, and get your X number of publications, get your whatever, build your network, you know, do the things that you're looking for, and then in 10 years, right? So I think that's the antidote to any kind of envy, is to have your own goals, to compete with yourself, and all the people around you. Yeah, sure, cheer for them. I cheer for Wrecker. I see Wrecker publish something, I'm excited. He's my buddy. I want him publishing something instead of these dummies who do increments.
Hate those guys.
Hate those guys.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it really doesn't end, right? I've met colleagues here who've moved from their PhD in Harvard to MIT, and that are just really angry that they didn't get their place at Harvard. And they're just really, I can't believe, once you get into that mindset, there's no end to it. There's no level of.
Well, you know, also I don't like this sort of a big institution name kind of thing. Like, maybe it's because I didn't come from a big institution. I come from a very technical, young, whatever tier university. Yeah, so never got into it. I was never at Harvard or Cambridge or any of the big schools. So I don't think that people that are associated with these institutions are necessarily better or worse or anything like this. It's a very individual, egocentric type of game. It's like what matters to me is what I do, mm-hmm. you know? And if Philip and Alex, if you're successful, well, good on you. That says a lot about you. It doesn't say anything about me. And to me, like, it also, Vienna doesn't say anything about you guys or vice versa. Of course, the environment matters. And some institutions give you better privileges, like better training, better conditions, better, God knows what else. Yeah, that does matter, absolutely. But it's not as simple as if I get into MIT and Harvard, I'll have a successful career. Absolutely not. Yeah. So it matters what you do and how you do it. And whether you can look yourself in the mirror. I think that's something that really is important. Like the goals, but also how I get to these goals and whether I abide by principles that I, you know, can face up to the scrutiny of myself. Yeah. Not whether you like me or not, but I can stand in the mirror and say, like, I'm a good person. Yeah. I do things the right way and so forth. I think that does matter eventually. Eventually, we all got to look ourselves in the mirror. And I think that matters.
Yeah.
And if you're more successful, good on you. Yeah. I mean, who cares?
And if you let envy kind of rule the day, you know, as someone just, I don't know, Alexander, did you just say this? Right. Springsteen said it. Poor man want to be rich. Rich man want to be king. The king ain't satisfied till he rules everything. Right. So that's the problem, is that there's always someone to be envious of. Right. There's always that professor at that other school that is doing more interesting things. And in you know, so like, look at in my field in tech, and what if I were jealous of others? I could look at, say, Scott Galloway at NYU, right? The guy's a celebrity. He's on CNN. He's got the most successful podcast. You listen to his podcast, it's like, this guy knows tech inside out. He's on every board. He's like, you know, who on earth is going to compete with that guy? So now, if I'm going to be envious, am I going to compare myself to Scott Galloway and then be following him with bitterness and every one of his successes? It's like, dude, I'm not even in that league. Let him do whatever he wants. I'll do my thing and I'm happy where I am. You know, I was in Amsterdam last week and having fun, and we had a really nice time. They have a phenomenal group there. Marlene and Hans Behrens and that group at Amsterdam. It's wonderful. And I'm enjoying my life, right? Why would I be jealous of another person? It doesn't seem very productive. There's always going to be someone better on whatever measure you think that you want to be playing, right?
And just to pick one, right? Think salary. Salary is usually a source of envy, right? You make more money than me. I make more money than you, whatever else. So a couple of years ago here in Europe, when I moved back to Europe, and I was looking, trying to figure out how the job market works here. And I had no idea, and very few people to that could help me. So I decided back then, it's like, well, with my friends, which are sort of, you know, professor age, whatever, that rank, no PhDs necessarily, we're just a bit older. We said, we're going to help each other. We're going to help each other. And whenever someone is up for a job talk somewhere, maybe he gets a promotion, maybe he applies for a position somewhere else, we're all going to step in and we're going to make sure everybody gets the maximum out of the negotiations. I don't get anything from that, but everybody else wins. Like, and I think that's we've been doing this ever since in our little circle. And it's wonderful because you know why? Because everyone now is better off than we would have been individually. And especially if we would have been envious and not share some of this information, the strategy and the tactics and the leverages and you know, whatever else. So you know, the reality is we all probably make a few $10,000 more than any of us would have could have possibly achieved by themselves if we all be envious in competition all the time. So I think that's a
and what you're talking about is community, right? Yeah. You're mentioning a community, and I think that helps get past envy in a sense, is if you have that. So just have your own goals and make a decision and not be envious. That's number one. Number two, if you have a community, right? You're part of a community. You're productive in that community. You're giving to the community. That community will value you. And I don't have to worry about whether Scott Galloway is better than me or not, because for me, in my whatever Academy of Management CTO, right, which is the communication, digital technology, and right, I'm one of the kind of leaders of this division. We're growing the division, you know, so I can contribute to that community. Academy of Management's the biggest. As a matter of fact, let me put a commercial. It's the biggest management conference in the world every year. This year, we're having it in Seattle in August, right? And then my little division, CTO, we're really opening the doors to a lot of the people in analytics and in computational spaces and cross-disciplinary. And right, Alexander, you are joining us this year for the doctoral consortium, right?
Oh, wow. And, congratulations.
And we're expanding this doctoral consortium. And to me, that's what I'm doing, right? When you have meaning, when you have a purpose, all of a sudden, it's not jealous. It's like, all right, how can I contribute to this group? How can I make this group better? How can I? And then that community kind of takes care of it. You know, I don't have to, I can find all kinds of people that are better than me in some other game. I'm playing this particular game and I think it's valuable, right? So I don't know. Is that a good anecdote, Philip?
No, that works. And I am happy for you, Alex. You're my community. And I know that you will always be sad. So that helps me.
You should invite your buddy then, Alex. Well, how long are you at Harvard, Alex? What's going on?
I'm leaving actually on Saturday. I was just here for 2 months on a research stay, which just opened up due to a community, because I had my professor had the email address of the guy at the lab, and that's, you know, that's how it worked. I'm not brilliant. I didn't go through some selection process. I just was lucky.
There's a lot of the luck of the draw with these things. I did my postdoc at University of Michigan. And why did I do that? Because my advisor called up his buddy. Tali called up John King at University of Michigan and said, hey, you want a postdoc? He's like, sure. So I went there to do a postdoc. You know, that there was no, so you just get lucky.
It's a community, you know? That you always talk about, right?
Yeah. So Philip, we're just going to start an academic racket where we just get people involved and start.
I want those tens of thousands of euros.
But you know, like the point is more like everybody, it's not a zero sum game. You're not going to lose anything if everyone else is successful. However, if you help each other, then everyone can actually be more, a little bit more successful. It's like John Nash in application here, right? So, you see the econometric people, they laughed at that joke, and Nick had no idea. He has the blank face. Like, what the hell John is a John Nash?
I think I've heard of that guy.
Oh, well.
Yeah, well, I think this is a great, positive, very unusually positive.
Unusually positive, yeah.
Yeah.
Usually you guys are usually whiners, aren't you? You're always grousing about the world. Yeah. Stop that. It's because you haven't worked in the real world, right?
I have worked in the real world. We both have.
You both. Then you should look at this like it's a luxury. It's a decadent luxury, this academic thing, right?
Yeah. The grass is always brown everywhere. It's like that. So, but yeah, this was brilliant. Really enjoyed it. We're very, very happy that you joined us. And so instead, usually what I do is I whine or rant about some company that I present as a sponsor. I won't do it this time. So I'd rather hear from you. Is there anything you'd want to plug beyond the Academy of Management and the Doctoral Consortium?
Well, the CTO division, they should go there because we have these PDWs around a lot of computational techniques, a lot of things around artificial intelligence and And or shoot me an email. If you're anywhere in academia and you want to know what's happening, I'll give you the standard email. But yeah, so that's the thing I want to plug. Hey, are you going to give us the answer at the end of this to the question?
Absolutely.
You won't forget to do that?
Okay. Absolutely.
Wrecker, is there something you wanted to plug though before he gives us the answer?
No, actually, I want to plug at least to the German capable listeners of our community to go and tune in to the PhD cast. I've done this before and because I'm, it's been years since I was a PhD student, obviously, but I felt it really refreshing to just look at it from the perspective of a grad student. I do think you moan a little bit too much and you whine a little bit too much. Not everything is just so negative. It is a thing we can enjoy and it does help, I think, right? So it is an enjoyable thing to do. It's a wonderful, luxurious privilege to be able to do that. I mean, someone gives you money so you can sit there and do what you're doing right now. And you just went to Harvard for crying out loud. All of that is wonderful. Name one other person in the world that can do that. You can look at it a little bit more positively. But by and large, I think it's a wonderful thing to have and it's really good to listen to as well. So, of course, it doesn't help you that you guys are German idiots and only talk about stuff in German, where you're more than capable to talk about the same things in English. And at least, And double your listenership, double it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but kudos on you. It's a great thing that you're doing. It really is. And a lot of people actually that actually really cherish what you're doing there. So everyone listening to the PhD cast available on all major platforms.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. And we've been dropping your podcast quite a lot in ours because it's got especially the last episode, I shared that as well, where you really also for all of us highlighted again, it is actually a privilege to be in this position. And it's good to hear, not just to hear the bad sides, but really to get it laid out about, what kind of privilege we have. So really also give This Is Research a listen. And I will now provide the answer to our little guesstimate. You all overshot, maybe because of the last time.
Yeah, that was me. Sorry.
It's 25% have shown moderate to severe symptoms of anxiety and depression in econ grad programs. But for the last year PhDs, it shoots up to 36%. So just about a third of econ grad students are at least on self-assessed measures not in a great place, but at least not as bad as you thought they were. So that's another positive note. But yeah, that was our lovely little crossover episode. We're always happy to we've got enough to talk about. So if there's any other opportunity to do this again, we'd be more than happy. And yes, that's it from our side. Thank you so much for listening to us. And you can follow us on the socials under our name and, rate us wherever you want. Rate This Is Research, rate our podcast on your listening device and program app of choice. Thanks so much again.
Just to drop the name of our podcast again, it's Desk Reject, the PhD cast. So it's easier to find.
There you go. You do a lot of advertisement, guys. You do a lot of advertisement.
Wow. We're just here for the clicks.
Yeah, here for the clicks. Yeah. Well,
oh, jeez.
Well, guys,
thanks.
Good luck in finishing a PhD. Eh? When are you guys finishing this year?
I hope next year.
Okay. Yeah, same year. I need to. For Philip, it's a hope. For me, it's an absolute deadline.
Well, good luck with that.
Thanks, though.
Thanks, guys, for the time. Really enjoyed it.
Bye, guys.